Hey guys, do you like this show? Do you like Current Geek? Do you? Well, you wouldn't be listening if you didn't, right? You're tuning in because you're into it. You like it. So how about help us out? If you like this content, and only if you do, go to patreon.com/frogpants and throw a little money our way. Maybe a dollar a month, if that's worth it to you. It's only for those that it's worth it to. But if it is worth it to you, dear listener, head on over there now. patreon.com/frogpants. All right, on with the show.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt.
Hey, I'm Tom Merritt.
Hey, man.
Ha!
You usurped me.
Step usurper. Sorry.
No, it's all good, man. How was your week? How you doing?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling Friday. Like I say, Current Geek means Fridays. Time to relax, unwind, look at some geeky stories.
Yeah.
Perfect way to kick off the weekend.
You got you getting prepped for a big South by Southwest visit next week? You excited about that?
Yeah. So, right off the top, folks, no Current Geek next week because I will be traveling. But the reason I'm traveling is to go to South by So Wasted, the yearly celebration of Diamond Club, which happens to happen at the same time as South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Just a coincidence. And there will be a meetup at 3 o'clock, I think I have the time right, 3 o'clock Central Time in Austin at the Handle Bar on Saturday.
Oh, the Handle Bar. Always hearing about that place. That's where Brian does a lot of his tricks and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Everyone look forward to that. We have a guest with us today. We always do. They're always great guests. And today's guest is a stand-up comedian, a co-host of one of my favorite video game podcasts called DLC over the 5x5 Network. His name is Christian Spicer, and he's here right now. Christian, how's it going?
Good, very well. Thank you. Excited to be here. I do think it's funny when you refer to someone doing tricks at a bar. I think, in case people don't know, he's a very good magician, and those are magic tricks that he's doing at the handlebar.
Is that what he does?
Oops. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where this is what I've learned. If you see Brian Brushwood in a bar or a restaurant or anything remotely like that, be on your guard. That's all I'm saying.
Be on his good side.
Yeah.
That's all. And then he'll get you a free drink.
Exactly.
For a scam or a trick.
Christian, you just put out an album. I just wanted to make sure to mention at the top of the show. Where can people get it? What's it called? And what's taking them so long to go pick it up? Because it's really good.
Oh, yeah, thanks. It's called Moment in Time. It's my debut stand-up album. It is not clean at all. I curse and I talk about sex and stuff like that. So go into that eyes wide open. But it's on iTunes, and it's currently number 12 on the Billboard charts, which was awesome. Like, total surprise. It's a self-produced little labor of love. But it's on iTunes, and you can just find the link for non-iTunes people at my website, ChristianSpicer.com. So if you like stand-up and nerdy stuff, I get into video games. And it's cool. I'm really proud of it.
Well, good.
That's fantastic, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, very, very cool. And having you on today makes perfect sense because you're into all that crap that we're into. Let's start it off with the top stuff.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Thomas, do the honors.
Should we rename this segment Top Crap?
Sure. Why not?
We get these mostly from the folks on our subreddit, currentgeek.reddit.com. So if you haven't checked that out, go take a look. It's a great place to find geeky stories on its own. Dee Basinge pointed out that International Business Times says sources familiar with their plan tell them that HBO will launch its internet-only service and call it HBO Now next month in April for $15 a month. And just as a side note, Game of Thrones premieres on April 12th. Mm. So possibly before that date would be my guess.
Yeah. HBO, why didn't they just say HBO Go Now? Like, just add another name to it.
That almost sounds like they're telling you to leave the room.
It does kind of, yeah. We're about to show Game of Thrones. Go Now! This is exciting. And we, been smelling this for years. And then certainly recently they've made all sorts of semi-official public conversations about it, and now it looks like it might actually be a real thing, and I'm very interested in this. Is the price confirmed? Do we know the 15 is
none of this is confirmed. Right?
Yeah.
Like, this is all sources familiar with their plan. The reason that I don't just dismiss this, though, because International Business Times, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't. it was repeated by Reuters, by Ars Technica, by a lot of, you know, very reputable sources who don't always pass along a rumor. So it makes me think that they also have their own sources that maybe they can't get confirmation out of, but they're like, well, this seems to fit together.
Christian, what do you think in a cord-cutting world? How does this fit with you?
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I'm excited about it. I do think $15 is likely the price just because it seems to be that's the typical ad for what it is if you have a cable subscription, so they're not losing that money. But I do think it's funny. Hopefully it launches before April 12th when Game of Thrones premieres, because then it will launch in April and also go down in April. I mean, that's ambitious, right? Because was it last season of games that crushed HBO Go? Yeah. And this is going to be, I mean, whoo.
It was bad. One would hope they'd have some infrastructure in place this time to handle said load, but I agree with you. It'd be nice to get at least a little time with it to see, but maybe it won't matter. If it's going to crash, it's going to crash, because who knows the kind of weight that's
going
to be.
Well, here's the hope, okay? Let me paint you the optimistic scenario.
All right.
First of all, HBO Go is run internally by Time Warner and by HBO specifically. Their CTO quit in December, and they handed over HBO Now development to Major League Baseball Advanced Media. Now, if you wonder, like, what does baseball have to do with this? MLBAM is the wholly owned subsidiary of Major League Baseball that does the streaming for Major League Baseball, but also a ton of other clients. They do streaming for WWE. They do streaming for Sony. They do streaming for a lot of people. So they're very experienced at this. And not that they haven't had their problems in the past, but I just got an email on DTNS today from a guy who works with Amazon Web Services pointing out a talk from the head of Major League Baseball Advanced Media, where he talked about using Amazon Web Services in a unique way to load balance and be able to adapt more quickly to changing bandwidth needs. And essentially, like, these guys have been doing it for a long time. Maybe this time it won't crash.
Where are you both HBO-wise? I am HBO-less. I borrow a password from time to time when there's something I need to watch for writing or for whatever. I buy seasons occasionally on iTunes. Are you two HBO-ers, or is this something that you'll be diving in day one?
Tom, you're a straight-up have-it-on-TV normal HBO guy right now, right?
Well, you're answering for me, yes. What about you, Scott? No, because the way I would say it is, we pretty much call DirecTV and ask them, like, what is the minimum we can continue to pay and still get HBO? And they're like, well, this is the discount we can give you now. Call us back in 3 months when it expires and we'll come up with something else then.
Yeah. So I'm a complete cord cutter and have been for pushing 6 years now, which is crazy. But I'll tell you, that kind of big bloating blister of I wish I had HBO was relieved some when it was lanced by, I'm sorry about carrying on this metaphor, but when Amazon swooped in and said, hey, we're going to get a bunch of archive content from HBO and a lot of the best shows that you've heard about over the last 10 years that maybe you've missed because you weren't subscribed, here they all are in their full glory. And I've seen the entirety of The Sopranos that way now. I've seen the first season of Boardwalk Empire, and I'm digging deep into The Wire now, and it's kind of doing for me what I needed it to do, or the kinds of things I was interested in. And that's mainly because I missed a lot of the frontline stuff when it was on. As far as new stuff like Game of Thrones, I'm also a password borrower as needed. That's how I've gotten it. And then sort of rewatches on DVD and things like that from previous seasons.
You've always relied on the kindness of strangers.
That's right. That's totally right. So I'm right in line with somebody who might want this. Now, if it's 15 a month, that feels high to me. I don't know why it feels high. I feel like they have a breadth of content. There's no question, and more than anybody else. But now that I have some of that on Amazon Prime, which I already pay for, a good deal of it, actually, archivally speaking, to just get really the new stuff via HBO, I feel like that ought to be closer to like $8 a month. Give me like Netflix pricing. I know it's nitpicky and it's $5 and who cares, but something about that number seems off to me. Time will tell. But April 12th, hurtling ever closer, Tom. We're not going to be able to handle it.
Yeah, I think $15 a month depends on what they give you. My guess is they're going to give you multiple streaming linear channels of HBO, hence the HBO Now. In other words, I can watch it right now. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go into an on-demand scenario. Mm-hmm. So the pitch will be, this is the same, as you said, Christian, this is the same that you would pay if you had a cable subscription. You just don't have to have one.
Well, exciting times. HBO blazing the trail, man, as far as premium cable goes. So we'll see how it ends up.
Next one comes from the Lewis guy. He sent us the article, but I lived it. 72-year-old Harrison Ford crashed his Ryan ST-3KR, it's a World War II-era single-engine plane, on a golf course near my house yesterday.
Whoa, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
First thing I noticed were the news helicopters outside at 2:30. I'm like, huh, where do those helicopters come from? Why are there four helicopters, like, over by the Santa Monica Airport? Well, it turns out it was because Harrison Ford's engine went out, and he was unable to land at the Santa Monica Airport. So he did apparently a very admirable job doing an emergency landing on a golf course near the Santa Monica Airport. He was banged up and receiving medical care, according to his publicist, described Ford's injuries as non-life-threatening, said everyone on the internet, dear Han Solo / Indiana Jones / Rick Deckard / Bob Falfa / President Marshall / Dr. Kimball / Jack Ryan, please stop flying old planes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that happened on the internet is the thing that always happens, is everybody starts telling really, you know, borderline inappropriate jokes about him, not knowing his condition, not sure how he's going to do, and would all feel very badly if he was, you know, injured in a very critical
Apparently
way.
He walked out of the plane, yeah. And he just had a lot of scratches and maybe some sprains and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and my thing with it was, you know, watching mainstream news outlets unironically and accidentally say things like flying solo, that cracked me up. Things like that were kind of funny as they came down the pipe, and people went meme crazy as soon as it happened, like we often do. But what I was struck with was just how much of a badass he is. He's flying this World War II era plane. Those things are known for failure regardless of how well they're upkept. Obviously knew his stuff. I rarely go to TMZ, but I went there long enough to hear the distress call that he made. Sounds like a pro. Did the textbook crash landing of that thing exactly the way you're supposed to do it, did it in a place he could find that was going to be the least amount of destruction to environment and people. Like, I'm kind of impressed with his flying career, and didn't even know it existed, didn't even know he was into this, but that kind of stuff made me go, oh yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. It brings up a different issue, though. Should we be flying World War II era planes in heavily populated areas? That's just a side question. Forget about
it. You know? I see it all the time. I was running. I tweeted this like last week or the week before. I was out running and I saw a biplane buzzing around my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. It just seems like it's a weird time to be doing that. Christian, what's your take?
But I guess the idea here is that I see it all the time, and this rarely happens.
Sure, sure. It's still
but no, that's when you know you live in a great neighborhood, though, is when you see the World War II era planes flying over your head. You live in a bad neighborhood if you see modern planes flying over your head. So you're in a good part of town if that's the stuff you see. It's recreational. Oh, dang it.
Yeah, and nobody got hurt outside of his injuries, right? He got a little banged up, a little scraped up. But
there was a tree that apparently may not survive.
All right. So, and there had to have been plenty of doctors around. It is a Los Angeles golf course, of course.
There were apparently doctors on the course. So the whole, like, is there a doctor in the house thing apparently did take place before the ambulance arrived.
That's amazing.
He was treated immediately.
And and his current condition, I guess, is he's doing fine and we'll probably be out of there and, you know, sequel to Blade Runner coming regardless. So that'll be good.
Yeah, apparently he's banged up and he got some cuts, but mostly everything I've read has said that he's, you know, medium condition, which is fine.
Yeah.
He's got some stuff that has to be treated. Maybe a broken bone. I don't know. They haven't said, but he's been in a couple of crashes before. And Iceworm made this joke, and I've seen a bunch of other people making this joke about, like, you know, he's never been good at landings. Ha ha ha. Right. Quoting The Last Crusade. But he actually did a very good job landing, I would say. His engine went out. It's not his fault.
Oh, it's exactly my feeling on this. Is he's completely impressed me. And I don't know how many 72-year-olds are flying World War II era planes and having the wherewithal to know exactly what to do and the textbook way to handle it. And it just really impressed me, all that stuff. So, look, there's a whole separate conversation to be had about, you know, somebody who's famous like this, how many of the memes we can come up with and whether or not that's, you know, something he would appreciate or not. I don't know, but in the end, I'm just glad he's okay. We can't have, you know, you had Spock pass away last week, which was really hard to deal with, Leonard Nimoy, and then, you know, the possibility of Harrison Ford not being with us. You're attacking two very important fronts of a lot of people's pop culture childhood here, and that would have been a little hard to take. So I'm glad he's fine, I guess.
I'm curious, Christian, Are you the kind of person who wants to see Harrison Ford make another Indiana Jones?
I would love to see another Indy. I don't know if Harrison Ford needs to be in it. I mean, it's that weird thing where do you want to see the character do the handoff? Is that the thing that makes you emotionally happy? Or is it better if they do, like, I'm excited for the new Ghostbusters. I kind of like that new idea of, like, it's just another one. One of my favorite franchises in that respect is Bond, where we don't care who it is, when it is. I don't need to see Uncle Ben die 18 times like Spider-Man makes me do every 4 years. It's just, let's just see an adventure. So I would love just to have a new Indy that is Indy and that is 28 and who cares, and here's this new actor doing it. I don't know if I need Harrison shaking Shia LaBeouf's hand or whomever, right, and being, yeah, go get him.
I'm with you there. Totally with you. Tom, I was going to ask you this. I almost forgot, so I'm glad you brought it up about sequels. He's, you know, reportedly going to be in the Blade Runner sequel playing his character, Deckard.
Oh, right, yeah.
Now, I'm no dummy, or I'm no dummy, I'm no expert when it comes to the lore behind that movie, its original book, Philip K. Dickishness, and all that. I'm sure you'd appreciate the way I said that. But do you think that this proves one way or the other that Deckard is or is not a replicant? Because that was, well, all the big talk, right? Like,
that's going to be the interesting thing, right? Because if he is a replicant, you know, and it kind of depends on which version of the movie you saw, whether the evidence points that way or not. Is 72-year-old Harrison Ford going to be a replicant? That, like, I just decided to age myself. Why not?
Right. So I don't know what the science is, the science in the movie behind all of that, but I know that the commentary on the DVD with him and Ridley Scott both saying out loud that they both believe that the character is not a replicant. I always thought that was the end of the argument, but apparently it has raged on since. And I wondered, you know, if an aging replicant was even in the cards. So I don't know.
Or do they Benjamin Button him? I mean, how often? I think it was the X-Men films where Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen,
yeah,
were both themselves, but very realistic looking younger versions of themselves. I mean, I think that'd be really interesting if Harrison played himself as a 30-year-old.
Oh, weird, right?
There is a prequel graphic novel to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep called Dust to Dust.
Mm. And does that have any bearing on his character or his age or any of that?
Well, it's a prequel, right? Oh. So he's younger.
I guess it wouldn't, yeah. Good point. I'll just hire some.
It's actually not even about Deckard. It's about who hunted androids before him, other Blade Runners.
Like Shia LaBeouf. There you go.
Yeah.
Story complete.
The obvious choice is
Shia LaBeouf. Or Jeremy Renner. It needs to be one of the two.
Yeah.
Great. What else we got? Ooh, movies. More movie stuff.
Yeah, if you've ever wondered what would happen if you watched 10 Marvel movies in a row and then watched the premiere of Avengers Age of Ultron, you can now gather empirical evidence. Tickets are on sale for the Ultimate Marvel Marathon, a 29-hour, 11-movie marathon beginning 6 p.m. April 29th with Iron Man and then going until 10 p.m. April 30th with an early screening of Avengers Age of Ultron. Both AMC and Regal Cinemas are hosting marathon events at various locations. Thanks to the Star Fury Zeta for the tip on this. I kind of want to do this.
Yeah, I really want. If I was 22, I'd do this. This would be the thing I was doing. I don't know if I have the kind of time that this would take now, nor I don't know if I have the staying power. Like, I'd eventually just start falling apart. But it's a really cool idea. Like, I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of people that are way into this, and they're all going to dress up and sit in their stinky Iron Man costumes the entire time and really go for it. But I don't know if I've got that in me anymore. Christian, could you, let's see if they even paid for it. Here, Christian, here's tickets to this huge, 29-hour, 11-movie marathon. Is that something you could even pull off in 2015?
I just wonder what the breaks are between this thing. I mean, is it back to back to back, or is it like a half hour break and you get to go? You know, I think if there's a little bit of a break for a bathroom break or something, I think it would be awesome. I didn't do this, but my suite mates did in college. They did, I forget what season it was, maybe season one or two, but they did 24 and 24 and 24, and they watched an entire season of 24 in 24 hours. And each episode, they had to eat one piece of pizza and drink one beer. And that might sound easy, but they were not happy.
Oh, I was going to say, by hour 8, I think I would be having an issue with that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is 29 hours. Like, what are you, I mean, how much popcorn can you not eat slash eat slash those are my dilemmas. Like I'd want to put Raisinets in my face. I'd want to, and then you're just like, but I shouldn't. But I would love to do this. I just don't know if I can.
Yeah. I'd be all about bean bags and I'd have to be able to lounge around a lot. I think I'd need breaks. Yeah.
Have you seen those new theaters? They have the rumble seats and they're really comfortable and they have, you know, footrests and everything.
Mm. Oh yeah. Like iPix, I think is one of them.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Mm. What if they also came with a toilet?
Wow. Well, it depends, I guess, who I'm sitting next to then, I suppose.
Lights are off.
Okay. Well,
some might say they already do if they're showing Iron Man 2.
Heyo. It's a cool idea. And again, I just feel like if I was at a different stage, although now, you know, I got a 14-year-old son, he and I could really have fun with this, but disappearing for 30 hours straight is just kind of an unheard of thing.
Make no mistake, we're just old men. I think this sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And if I were 21, would totally be there.
Slash Films got the article. Do they have a schedule? I don't know if they do. Or like a location picker kind of thing for where... who's doing it. You probably just have to check your local
AMCs and Regals. Yeah. There are links in the Slash Film article to AMC and Regal. Yeah. So you can find the press releases for that and check locations and stuff.
And you guys,
it's the ultimate Marvel movie marathon 2015. So you want to look for that listing on either the AMC or Regal sites.
And it's probably not enough to make it its own article on this week's show, but the new Marvel or the new Avengers 2 trailer rather looks awesome.
Yeah,
as stoked
I couldn't
as ever.
Put my finger on why, but it just really got me fired up.
Yeah, I'm really stoked. I don't like that the Hulk has a bloody eye. That makes me concerned that he's not supposed to be able to get those. He's supposed to not get hurt.
That's so. Just how powerful the big Iron Man suit is.
I guess so. Enough to poke him in the eye or give him pink eye. Maybe that's all that's happened here. He's just giving him a nice little bacteria infection.
From a microscope, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
By the way, the Regal Cinema site lists the marathon locations. Mm. They are Ontario, California, Atlanta, Georgia, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and Houston, Texas.
Whoa. King of Prussia.
Yeah.
Kicking it.
AMC may have more because they just ask for your zip code and then they'll tell you. Mm. They have AMC. They have the list of when the movies start. And I don't have the movie runtimes, but you could look at that and kind of figure out how much time they're putting between the movies.
So the early screening, that's just a day before you'd normally the Age of Ultron releases, right? That's on May 1st. So, okay, that makes sense. So they're going to, you're committing to perhaps either have the greatest time of your life as a Marvel fanboy at this thing, or you're going to come out the other end wishing, hoping you'll never see another Marvel movie again.
You're going to know so many plot holes.
Yep. You're going to notice Chris Hemsworth's hair shifted around a little bit between Thors or something.
This is clever. In my location, one of the places they're doing this is the dine-in theater.
Oh, cool. So you could eat.
Yeah. You could have the food brought to you.
Nice. That sounds all right. Rumble seats, food in your belly. All set.
Toilet seats. Come on.
Come on, AMC. Get your crap together.
Or you could just live in a virtual world. And we got a ton of announcements about that at the Game Developers Conference earlier this week. Sony Worldwide Studios President Shu Yoshida announced that the Project Morpheus VR headset will come to consumers in the first half of 2016. Morpheus will have a 5.7-inch 1920 by 1080 OLED display with a 100-degree field of view and a 120-hertz refresh rate. Headset will also have 9 LED trackers on it so that you can do 360-degree tracking of your head.
So I know we're going to get to the Vive here in a second. Did VR heat up real fast or is it just me?
Should I just give you the specs on the Vive?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
And then we just have a big old VR party?
Sure.
Because they announced a new Samsung Galaxy Gear, which is the one that you need the Note 4 for. The new one is going to work with the Samsung Galaxy S6, which was also announced. HTC announced Vive, a virtual reality headset made in partnership with Valve, coming this spring to developers. This is not a case you slide in HTC phone in, though. It is actually a full-on Oculus Rift competitor. Plugs into your PC, works with a tracking system that Valve made, partnered with Google, Lionsgate, and HBO, among others, to make content. Along with that, Valve announced the input system and Lighthouse. That's the room scale tracking system that will work with Vive. The system that tracks the headset can integrate into televisions, into monitors, into headsets, into input devices, into your mobile device. And Valve is going to make that available freely to hardware manufacturers to put in whatever they want.
So the Vive was the first out of the gate, and that was kind of their flagship for GDC demos and stuff. And everyone I've talked to who was on site and tried that thing out at GDC came away declaring that setup the winner ahead of all this other stuff, better than Oculus's current leading demo kit, which I forget
Crystal the, Cove.
Crystal Cove, is it called? Yeah. They liked it better than that. And these are guys that have had experience on all of them. They liked it better than Sony's, although they were speaking quite highly of Sony's. But out of kind of nowhere, and everyone thought, well, what's Valve doing? What's Valve doing? We don't know what they're doing. We know they got something going on. But their head of VR, like not long ago, a year or two ago or whatever, left to go work at Oculus. Everyone thought, well, that means they're not doing great, or they're going to scrap it, or maybe they'll just embrace Oculus or something. But turns out they were hard at work on a pretty rad competitor. And the comments I'm getting from people who have used it are saying the kind of one-to-one sense of presence that you're really interacting in this space is really nailing it. And the other thing is they don't feel sick on it ever, which is a huge hurdle that a lot of these guys have had a hard time getting over. I don't know if you guys have used the SDK or the DevKit 1, and my gosh, you'll want to hurl the minute you put it on your head half the time. So I'm beyond excited about this, but I just am so surprised how quickly VR went from one company kind of working on it, Facebook money injected, Sony sort of interested, to just now full blown like horse race, arms race to the end. And that seems good, like a meaningful turn of events for a technology that everyone claims will actually be a huge impact on the industry and maybe a revolutionary product. It seems like this all this excitement supports that. I'm stoked. Christian, you ready for your VR life to begin and never end?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I think Sony's at a disadvantage. Well, assuming the facts I'm about to assume, if it's limited to their console, I think that is a very limiting approach to VR, where a lot of the excitement seems to be in, you know, what you can do in a PC, what you can hack into a PC in that regard. And then the Valve announcement kind of irks me a little bit, because it seems very similar to their Steam Machine approach of their quote-unquote console, where it's like, we're making this software and, you know, a lot of hardware makers will make their thing. So how standard will things be? How universal is it? Because I feel like the first person out of the gate, if they don't nail this thing, if it's not awesome, you only get one chance at VR. Well, one chance every 15 years, right? When was the last time we tried
this? We forgot Virtual Boy. Yeah. It's okay now.
Sure. Everything's right. Fine. Yeah. A Lawnmower Man turned out to be complete bullcrap. We've moved past that one. Now we're in the new one. You're totally right, though. I agree with that. There's a real shot here. And it feels like all the tech is in place anyway. Now, the real question will just be who's got the most refined experience or what makes the most sense. You know, there's a lot of complaints about, well, these all need to be wireless, but we don't have the technology to have good latency-free wireless yet, to the point that they need to be, that will help tackle issues of nausea and stuff.
That's like Cardboard or the Gear VR, right? Mm-hmm. That's the wireless solution where you're like, we'll just use a phone.
Right.
But that is much more limited than what you can do with the Vive or with the Oculus Rift or Morpheus.
Plus, people are complaining about Samsung Gear makes them sick. Like, they just can't, it's not, you know, and even Samsung's admitted and warned people, said, look, it's like getting off of a splashing around cruise ship or whatever. You may walk out of there with motion sickness, eye twitching, you know, dizziness, disorientation, that kind of stuff. So even they are kind of having to admit that. What's his name at Valve? Forgot his name all of a sudden. Anyway, Lord Valve.
Gabe Newell.
Gabe Newell, thank you. Got up and said,
I prefer to call him Lord Valve.
He's also, by the way, a new billionaire worth $1.3 billion, according to Forbes. Anyway, gets up and says, zero motion sickness, which is the great barrier on this thing, or one of the great ones. That's a big claim, man.
I think if all of them had a little motion sickness, people would be like, well, it's not for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. That's like 3D movies or roller coasters.
Right.
You know, like, it can still be really popular. But if you can say zero motion sickness, suddenly it's like, there's no barrier to anybody.
Yeah.
Everybody
deliver that, and other than people with certain vision impairments. But if you deliver that, suddenly it's like, no, you've literally just replaced the world you were standing in with a new world, but your interaction within it is the same as if you're moving around in a room or whatever. If we can get that, and it sounds like because Christian, I'm with you. I'm cautiously optimistic, but man, it just feels like we're there. We're on the edge, and I'm stoked. So bring it.
Then we just need the experiences. That's the next thing, right? They all have great tech demos of a lot of them want to show you a shark. Yeah. But I just feel like development of a game or a unique thing seems to take a long time these days. And, you know, if these things are not, Oculus still hasn't released final specs, Valve has, Sony has, but where are the games, what are the experience that you put on that's more than, you know, Wolfenstein in this thing or more than Halo in this thing? It's, you need to do this because you're in this world. Holy crap. Now we're playing Skyrim. Mm-hmm. Like I need that. Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to see the whole picture of what Valve's doing, because you've got the Steam machines coming, which a lot of people have said, well, why would I want a Steam machine? You know, some people totally see the value, but a lot of people think it's a little unnecessary. But if suddenly, oh, guess what your Steam machine can do? It can work really well with the Vive. In fact, it's got the tracking built in. So suddenly this one-to-one tracking that everybody's raving about, you can use. And yes, you can buy the Vive for the holidays. It is the gift to give. And you can use it with all of these Steam library-based games. I mean, they're going to drop like a ton of bricks, an entire virtual reality ecosystem on everyone before the holidays.
Yeah. November, man. That's the crazy bit to me. I just felt like VR was going to be in development for an interminable amount of time. And now here we are with an actual thing I can pick up this fall. So, yeah.
Apparently, all you have to do is get John Carmack out of your company and send him to Oculus.
Yeah, everything's good. Everybody wants to flip out and compete at that point. But you know what I mean about, like, everybody scrambling for this? It's like any business, like mobile or whatever, it's always better when a million people want to get in on it. And there's a moment right now where I just feel like everybody wants in. And, you know, even Microsoft with their weird AR thing is kind of in the same space. Like, everybody's all in all at once. That seems like that should push good competition, which should push good innovation, which hopefully results in something we consumers can pick up and have.
For $500?
Yeah, well, see, here's the trick.
$200?
There's the rub. I think $300. I think you can do this thing for $299 and you're going to hit the sweet spot. I'm not sure they can do it for that, but
yeah, I think if they say $299, mm-hmm, everyone will be okay. If it's less than that, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And they'd just be selling it as a loss leader at that point, I think.
And people, I don't think people would value it as much. I think if you said it was $150, people would go, that seems a little janky and a little cheap. Like, I'm being taken for a ride here. If you say $500, you're probably pushing the upper limit. You know, if you say $299, maybe $399, you're probably in the right price point. The real question is whether Sony will land at a price point that makes sense for them, because they are really dedicating their dedicated VR experience to a dedicated console machine for a dedicated generation.
At least they're dedicated.
Yeah, they're dedicated. So they can't have this outrageous $600 peripheral to add on to your already $300 or $400 console, or at least in theory you can't. For the PC, somehow it seems more reasonable to say, well, I'm going to add another $399 thing to this, because even though I've already spent $2,000 on it, it does all these other things for me. That aren't just gaming related, and I feel like they have an easier time there. So Sony has probably the biggest challenge, but potentially the biggest install base. So, you know, excited.
I think it was really interesting, too, that Mobile World Congress, which is a cell phone and tablet convention in Barcelona, had as much VR news coming out of it. The Vive was introduced by HTC at Mobile World Congress first, and then Valve did the second part with the announcement of Lighthouse at GDC, at the Game Developers Conference. So this is definitely becoming the year of VR at this point.
Yep. So I'll see you on the other side.
One more thing from GDC. NVIDIA announced the Shield game console. If you want something for $199, this is it. Runs Android TV on a Tegra X1 chip capable of handling 4K video. It can also access games from NVIDIA's new Grid Cloud Gaming Service, which finally is coming out of beta in May. Users can choose a subscription tier of 720p at 30 frames per second or 1080p at 60 frames per second starting in June. You can also buy or rent additional games from the Grid store. Users with a GeForce-powered PC can also stream their entire Steam library to a Shield on the same network. Shield will also be available in early May.
Yeah, this is the one I'm not so sure about in terms of adoption rate. I don't know. It seems like a pretty cool idea. The subscription model is kind of weird how they're gating it. It's like standard definition versus high definition movies on Amazon or iTunes or something, where like one costs a little more than the other because you're getting a higher resolution and a better frame rate. I don't know how I feel about that gating. That part's weird to me, but maybe that's good because some people's connections can't do one over the other. But really, what is this? It's basically the old Shield mashed in with an on live service mushed in with, you know, I guess in-home streaming. And I guess Android TV wants to be a big deal. So I don't know. Why does this not get me excited? Christian, when you heard the news, did you go, oh, yeah, my next console is this?
It's because we're not there yet. VR is easier to get excited about because it's the thing that you put on and you're like, this is awesome. But I think this type of stuff is the future. But it's not there. It needs to be consistent. We need one player that comes in and proves that it works. But man, this gets me more excited than VR because I love the idea. I'm in Austin right now and I live in LA, but I love the idea of like, I just bring a controller with me and this is built into everyone's TV or, you know, it's as... ubiquitous is the right word I want. Wi-Fi, right? So you visit your friend, they have Wi-Fi, then you can play any game that you want, that you own, that you have access to anywhere, and that is awesome. Mm-hmm. Pick up where you are. You don't need to bring your Vita or, you know, whatever. But we're just not there. But I love that NVIDIA they're really toying with all of this stuff, and I hope they figure it out. I feel like this is another cool step because this is awesome.
Well, and these are those guys, Tom, we talked earlier in the week about how it seems like a company like NVIDIA can't just be, we're video card makers and chip manufacturers for the end of time. They have to figure out ways to diversify, and this is the area they've chosen to do it, which is all related, of course. It's all gaming related and entertainment connected and all that, but people are real down on this. Like maybe that's what I'm reacting to, or at least it's rubbing off on me or something, but the gaming press has been real cold to
this
announcement.
This is the virtual boy. But it's not great. And the pricing is not great. And we don't have access to games and internet's not great and blah, 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 blah. But 20 years later, it will be, this is the thing that's just, of course you have that. Mm-hmm. And then you get angry when it doesn't work. Like when I'm hiking in the middle of nowhere and I'm upset that I can't tweet a picture because I'm like, this is ridiculous. I can't send an image to space and have it go to other people via space. Like,
what is wrong with this world?
Yeah.
Good point.
I think if Grid comes out in June and people start using it and say, wow, this is so much better, not the lag everybody was worried about, it has a chance. But It's a very big hill to climb. NVIDIA seems confident enough to bring it out of beta. Well, they're putting their money where their mouth is, I guess.
I wonder if that PlayStation Now, which I played a little bit with in the beta, which is now out and available to anybody, which is the same thing. It's their Gaikai converted service that lets people rent games and do it in a way with subscriptions and everything. That seems pretty solid. If they provided an experience that was at least on par with that in terms of, you know, reliability, they'd probably be fine.
And someone who is working for NVIDIA out there in the audience is shouting at you right now, that's exactly what we're going to do, Scott.
Yeah, and they're probably right. I realize I sound down on it, and I kind of am, but I don't know why it is. It's a combination of things. Like if this console would have been the thing that Valve was launching, like if this was the new Steam Box announcement, something tells me I'd be more excited, and I don't know why that is. Is it because of Steam and its established, levels of quality when it comes to, you know, the service to have for getting games on PCs and how it's kind of changed the PC landscape, and so I'm shifting some of that goodwill over to this? And am I giving NVIDIA short shrift because they make video cards, and what are you guys doing in the gaming space other than making video cards? What are you doing over here? I don't know. I'm willing to admit that some of my biases are rolling around in funny ways with this.
Well, I think the other problem is that some of this depends on things out of NVIDIA's control that then the end user will blame on them, where people have crappy internet, but they don't think they have crappy internet because they're getting the most expensive package they can. But internet for a lot of people in the US is crappy. So why can't I do the 1080? Why is it laggy? This is a crappy product. And NVIDIA is probably screaming, no, 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 our product is great. Your infrastructure is crap. Or you're behind a horrible firewall. You brought it to your office and it's getting blocked. Like, you don't know what you're doing. There's a lot of other stuff mm-hmm. that's out of their control that's not centralized or whatever.
On the other hand, Christian, NVIDIA is saying that the low-end plan only requires a 5 Mbps connection.
Right, right.
So they're kind of asking for it, is I guess what I'm saying.
Sure.
Yeah, and but remember OnLive was that, and it seemed like that was a much stiffer thing then. Like, we've definitely gotten some better bandwidth for a lot of people since on live was making the 5 megabyte per second pitch. But even then, in North America anyway, things kind of still suck in a lot of places. So there's a huge, that's a big hill to get up. And Christian's totally right. When the infrastructure challenge of this is gone, it's just ubiquitous and there the way power is today, then this all goes away. Then you can do crazy things. It won't matter about any of that because that will just all work. You don't ever think, oh, I can't plug this new hairdryer in because the power's weird. I don't know if I'm going to have enough power to run my hairdryer. Well, you'll always have enough power for your hairdryer now. But back in the 20s and 30s, maybe you didn't. You know, something would, you browned out the whole neighborhood, Bill. Good job with your curling iron.
With your electric razor. Why isn't a regular razor good enough for you, Bob?
Right. These are the things we do. And no offense to Bob listening to the show.
Sorry, Bob. Your beard looks wonderful.
Yeah.
So there you go. I mean, I think what we're seeing is that virtual reality is near iPhone level of acceptance. And you see that in people reviewing the Vive and surprisingly saying, you can read the surprise in the reviews from all different sources. Like, wow, it really was good. Like, we kind of didn't expect that. Whereas something like Shield, they're like, yeah, we're still sort of in the Microsoft tablet circa 2001, right? Sure. It's like, you can see the promise, but...
But maybe you use the Shield within the Vive. So the Shield doesn't exist. You put on your VR, and in that VR world, the Shield works, and everybody's Shield happy?
Also, you know, if you can say one thing about the early tablets of the early aughts that Microsoft was pushing, it's the best thing about them is that they provided this allegory, this cautionary tale.
Excellent handwriting, and wonderful allegories.
Yeah, but it's a great comparison to say, look, sometimes certain ideas are way ahead of their time. Yeah. And VR was ahead of its time when Sega told me they had something cool to put on my head and it sucked. And I went, ugh, this is bad. That was like 25 years ago. And now finally there's something cool. So yeah, everything always comes around. Great ideas. Star Trek stuff eventually happens. Everyone just calm down and accept it.
And of course, speaking of Star Trek, we mentioned the sad passing of Leonard Nimoy on last week's show. Just a quick note, Star Fury Zeta letting us know that Cryptic Studios has created a permanent memorial to Leonard Nimoy and Spock in the world of Star Trek Online, the MMO. Nimoy did some voice work for that game. If you've played it, you've heard him narrating introductions to locations. So they have some statues now, and even a memorial plaque for all of the past actors from the Star Trek original series that have passed away.
That's a cool thing. And that game's that game's still kicking it. I hopped in, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, and I was surprised how that game's improved and how it's still doing great. And apparently are making good money in the free-to-play market. And something about that makes me happy. And it's in such a WoW-saturated world, as much as I love that game, it's nice to see other games like this. And then, you know, of course, this would be a great thing to do in your game. If your game's about Star Trek, you gotta show some love to those who, you know, establish the legacy in the first place. So that's pretty cool. And Christian, since you weren't here to say anything about it last week, I loved hearing people's, what the impact of Leonard Nimoy and that character were on them as either kids or lovers of science fiction or whatever. You have a take on that you want to share with us?
I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way because I really don't mean it to, but it was almost like losing, it was like an Old Yellow moment where it's like you feeling like you losing that family dog where you know it's going to happen. And then when it happens, you're kind of like, well, of course that was going to happen. And then the next day you wake up in a Spockless world and it really is just like someone's not hugging you anymore.
Yeah.
And it feels really weird, but you move on and you know it's going to happen. But that's the best analogy I have. It was like losing the dog that died when I was 10. And you're just like, man, you don't really know how to express it other than it's the worst thing, right?
Yeah, totally. Well...
And we also lost Harve Bennett.
He
just passed away. The producer of so many things, plenty of Star Trek things, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek III, Search for Spock, IV, The Voyage Home, V, Final Frontier. Yeah. He was even producing, you know, all the way up into the 90s, things like Invasion America and Time Tracks.
Yeah. No, that guy was great.
$6 Million Man he produced?
Yeah, isn't that great? I want to say he worked with Glenn Larson on projects and things. A bunch of stuff we love, like 80s TV at its worst and best, in my opinion. Some of that.
He was an actor. I'm just looking at his IMDb thing. He was in The Final Frontier as Starfleet Chief of Staff and in the search for Spock as the flight recorder voice.
Oh, perfect. Flight recorder voice. Weird. All right. Well, yes, rest in peace him and, of course, Leonard Nimoy. And we'll jump to our next thing. Before we do, though, real quick, we got to mention at least one more time on this show, Tom's new book. And I'll let Tom do it because he's way better at explaining it than me.
I just got the printed version of it. Citadel 32, cover by Scott Johnson, yeah, which makes it look so much better than it deserves to. So buy it just for the cover, if nothing else. But yeah, it's my attempt at science fiction. It's a story about a base on the moon and a man that finds a strange discovery that could possibly lead to reconnection with Earth, which was lost in an apocalyptic scenario. And meanwhile, on Earth, a monk of the Citadel discovers a strange ancient artwork that could lead to the truth about the myth of moon men. So those two stories kind of head towards each other. If you're interested, go to tommerrittbooks.com.
Yeah, buy the hard copy and bring it to Nerdtacular and have a sign.
Yeah.
We'd love to do that for you. All right, let's lean in hard to what we like to call the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
Oh, man. Christian, I probably didn't warn you enough about this. Actually, it's not that big a deal. But we get to test your knowledge in an area of your expertise. I decided to pick one behind your back, that area of expertise, because I try to do that occasionally just to surprise people. You'll be asked a series of questions, and just for fun, you'll answer them in the positive or negative. And if you get it right, if you get it wrong, and Tom will score the whole thing in the only way he knows how, which is super weird and it makes no sense. So here we go.
Makes perfect sense to me.
I'm going to... Oh, I thought I had this up. Hold on. Pop quiz. There we go. Okay. Christian Spicer. There he is. Okay. So here is your pop quiz that for some reason isn't opening. Okay. There we go.
I win.
You win. we have for you, my good man, PlayStation trivia. PlayStation trivia. Now, I know you're a fan of the platform. You've enjoyed your Vita and your PlayStations in the past. You've also had, you know, fair criticisms about Sony and what they do. But it seemed like a platform where you played a bunch of games on it and therefore might have some knowledge. So here's your first question. What was the retail price at launch for the Sony PlayStation 1?
$399.
You are incorrect by $100. It was $299, if you can believe it.
Wow. Maybe. Okay. That's great.
Yeah. Missed those days when consoles were $299.
I don't mind being wrong too high.
You do lose 100 points, one for every dollar you're off.
Oh, yeah. Great. See? There you go. Next up, when was the first DualShock controller released in the United States?
Oh, well, it was for the PlayStation 1. When in terms of months?
I'll tell you what. I'll give you year. If you get months, maybe Tom will give you bonus points. But
this is tough. Please, I don't know. Can people see me? I'm not looking anything up. I'm not stalling to try to Google.
Nope.
October 2001.
You are incorrect. It was May 1998.
Really?
98 being the greatest year in video game history, which also included the advent of the DualShock controller. Correct. I know it seems early to me too, but apparently that is correct. All right, here we go. Next one. Which version of Madden NFL was never released for the PlayStation, for the Sony PlayStation?
Well, I mean, this is my attorney background. I mean, that's a dumb question because all of them that were released for the Genesis. I get a point for every single Madden that came out before the PlayStation 1 was released. I'm now back to zero. I'm winning this game. I love it.
I'm going to give you one of these kind of at the same time. Madden 96 is the correct answer. The game was under development but had several delays and was not released for the PlayStation. The team behind Madden 96 on the PlayStation would later make NFL 2K games. Fact, NFL 2K, 2K is still the greatest football game ever made.
Now, you actually get a 200-point clever answer bonus, but then you lose 99 points for misinterpreting scoring rules.
Oh!
Zing. All right, next up. What division of Sony was behind many of the first-party games, including Twisted Metal and Jet Moto?
San Diego?
You are incorrect. It is 989 Studios. Interesting.
That's San Diego.
Is that San Diego now? Well, they were closed in 2001, reopened in 2005. But are they the same studio? That one might be a tricky answer, Tom. You may have some fun scoring with that.
They're
one
out of San Diego.
You're right. They're there no matter what. Well, who's the Santa Monica studio? Is that just they're in Santa Monica? Is that the only reason that sets them apart?
I guess. Their successor was SCE San Diego. I at least give him a half point.
All right.
If you say full point, I'll give him full point. You tell me how correct the answer is.
I think that he's more correct than not.
Well, let's give him the full point.
All right, full point.
And then having to go through the agony of being questioned without basis, extra bonus points.
Nice. To be clear, I am glad I'm not doing great at this because people already yell at me for being a Sony fanboy. So I think this proves not.
Yeah, I think this gives you this gives you all kinds of space now to work in. All right, here's the next question. What year was Metal Gear Solid released on the PlayStation?
1998.
You are correct. It was, again, the greatest year in video game history. Every important game was released that year. StarCraft, that, Zelda, Ocarina of Time. It's an amazing year.
GoldenEye?
GoldenEye was as well. You're right. And so was Half-Life 1, for heaven's sakes. Yeah. It was an amazing year. All right, next up. Where was I? Oh, okay. How many titles were available at launch for the PlayStation? The answer can just be a number. You don't have to tell me which titles they were.
PlayStation 1?
Yeah. PS1.
Seven?
You are close, but not quite. It was 10 total. Battle Arena Toshinden, ESPN Extreme Games. I own both of those. Kill Eek, the DNA Imperative. I don't know who remembers that. NBA Jam Tournament Edition, Power Serve 3D Tennis, The Raiden Project, Rayman, Ridge Racer, Street Fighter, the movie, and Total Eclipse Turbo, which...
So much crap.
Such garbage, dude. I thought I enjoyed Toshinden, but I don't think it was as good as I think it was.
No, it was awful, but it was, at the time, OMG Revolution. It was that and Ridge Racer, which Ridge Racer holds up. Toshinden, yeah. Garbage.
Garbage, yeah, it's hot garbage. ESPN Extreme Games had some moments. It was like...
what moments?
It was like, what was the game with the motorcycle? Road Rage. Was it Road Rage? Road Rash.
Road Rash, yeah.
Road Rash is one of my favorite series of all time, except for me not remembering the name. I just kind of thought there was a piece of that in ESPN Extreme. Just a tiny bit, that's all. It wasn't great, though.
Also lose 0.3 points for being 3 off.
All right, fair enough. Second to last question. What was the final game released in the United States for the original PlayStation?
Oh, man. I have no idea, but I hope it's something awesome and iconic that, like, had legacy implications to it, but it probably wasn't. But let's just go with some form of... let's say Crash Kart Racing. Bandicoot Kart Racing.
I wish you were correct. Sadly, it was FIFA Football Soccer 2005.
Oh, of course. Yes.
It was the true final game on the console. Technically, the true final game was this German-only game in 2005 called Schnappy Three Fun Games, which is apparently the worst thing ever made and not notable in any other way. So there you go.
And also, you get a point because you were correctly said, I have no idea.
Nicely done. All right, final question. It's the big one. Crash Bandicoot was the de facto mascot for the PlayStation for a while and was featured in several live-action commercials for games and consoles. What competitor's corporate office parking lot does Crash do commercials from?
I can see the commercial. He gets out of the car. He has the bullhorn.
Yep.
And he is in front of Sega.
You are incorrect. It was Nintendo.
Really?
Remember, he was like, come on, plumber boy. He was calling out the plumber boy to come fight him. He stood in front of that parking lot. There's actually a video of it. Let's see if I have a clip.
Yeah, those are great ads.
Yeah, they were awesome at the time. And I was trying to remember when I saw the question at first, was Sega even a problem for them? So here's a bit.
Hey, plumber boy, mustache man, your worst nightmare has arrived.
Those were great.
I just thought, in my head, my rationalization was that they were trying to out-edge Sega. Where, like, Sega does what Nintendo don't. So I pictured Sony going, we kill people. Yeah. I don't know.
Everybody's after Nintendo, it turns out. Well, yeah. You did, I think, a fine job. Tom, add him up. How'd he do? How'd it go?
First of all, clarification. Ice Worm says in the chat room that GoldenEye was released in 97.
Oh.
Although... was, you know, near the end, so it had success in 98. That's why we remember it that way.
Yeah.
And the final point tally for you, Christian, is 4.7.
Whoa, yes. That's not bad. That's higher on the average than most of our guests, so you're in there. You're in the pantheon.
You say that to all the guests.
I know, I have no idea. I have no numbers in front of me. I make it up completely. So good job. Way to go. And we'll play that again sometime. All right, it's time for us to do a little forecast.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
And now, once again, the sad admission. This used to be a show. Now it's a segment. Oh, some people are real sad about that. But it's where we talk about things in the future, things that are happening way ahead that we can try to predict. And I've got one. I've noticed lately that there is every... It's getting harder and harder to schedule a convention like we have with our little Nerdtacular event for Frog Pants folks, because I realize that it doesn't matter what weekend I choose, it will conflict with something. And it's gotten worse over the years to the point that I think right now we are really at like peak convention. And I'm not saying there's going to be a crash or anything. In fact, my prediction is this. There are so many conventions that serve a lot of the same people, like nerdy, Comic-Con-y, video gamey kind of convention-y things, that at some way, or at some point in the future, they'll start to figure out ways to combine these, like joined forces, as a way of dealing with scheduling and venue requirements and that sort of thing. So you might see, for example, I don't know, CES joined forces with Mobile World Congress as a tiny example or something.
Well, and there is precedent for that. I want to say it's one of the photo conventions, and now I'm blanking on whether it was Photokina, but I don't think it was. I think it was the other one, and now I can't remember what it's called, merged into CES.
So that makes sense to me. And so in that case, it just got called CES and they came in. In other cases, it could literally be like Wizard World meets WonderCon kind of combined thing, which is really a shared audience and kind of for the same people and all of that. And I know a lot of this is like, well, you have them in different parts of the country to service those regions.
PMA, that's what.
Sure. But it just seems like they're running out of weekends and time, and they're starting to saturate the same audiences. And I don't know that this is a bad thing necessarily, but you know, it's hard to split your time, especially if you're one of those guys that wants to go to all of them and he's got to really pick and choose. I've seen a lot of friends having to do this now, and they didn't have to so much 5 years ago. It was kind of a different market then. Any thoughts on that, Christian, about the state of conventions?
I fear it's going to be attrition and not combination. This isn't going to be Voltron. This is going to be Sega, where some of these just won't make it and they won't last, because it's kind of everybody, like VR, I think it's going to go the same way, where everybody's jumping on this thing. I mean, heck, Sony threw their own thing this year and called it a con, but it was kind of expensive, or they called it a fan experience, but you had to buy tickets, whatever.
Right.
I just don't think that all of these can last, and everybody wants to do it because everybody can, you can get your message out in a cool way, and you know, people are gobbling this stuff up. But I don't see PAX combining with GDC or Comic-Con. I mean, could you imagine how fast would those tickets sell out in your crazy future? Like, that's insane. Where would it be to combine these things?
Plus, they're already doing that. Like, the big ones, you know, like take San Diego Comic-Con's example as an example. That thing's just freaking huge. 160,000 people at the cap, and they tickets sell out in an hour or whatever. BlizzCon.
Before programming's announced.
BlizzCon sells within minutes of those going on sale, and that's capped at like 30,000 or whatever it is in Anaheim. You're not wrong. And when they're real specialized, like Gen Con, probably never do this because they are so focused on tabletop gaming. Like, that's their whole bread and butter. And, you know, PAX is 100% video games. But it just seems like there's a lot of middle tier stuff that could benefit. And maybe I'm even talking about stuff we don't know about, like two dental conventions that happen in Texas at the same time, or... You know, like, it just seems like how much convention space is there? And we just seem so convention happy as a culture compared to in days past. And maybe none of this is even a problem, but it just seems like a lot, and a lot of shared audience, and a lot of sort of splitting the vote in a way.
I got two things to say. One is, I'm going to split the difference between you two and say that there will be some that will just die by attrition because they don't like each other. Yeah. And I'm not going to name names, but I know examples of this in certain cities where, like, breakaway factions from one con go and start their own con that happens at a different time of the year. They're never going to get back together, right?
Right.
But there also maybe PMA, as I mentioned, was one that started to work with CES at the same time. And others have done that as well. And I could see that happening in some cases, especially as conferences start to change their dynamic and change their definition. For instance, CTIA used to be the big conference for mobile, but it got kind of stuck in the feature phone world, and Mobile World Congress became the big conference for smartphones. So now the question is, well, as smartphones are becoming a commodity, can Mobile World Congress become a new kind of conference, or is it going to have to pivot and go somewhere else? So I think both of those things will happen. The other thing I want to point out is, hey, remember when all the people said that because of the internet, it'll be horrible because no one will want to leave the house anymore and nobody wants to meet in person anymore? I think the explosion of these cons is evidence of the fact that people who meet on the internet actually want to meet in person more so than they did before.
Completely. Yep. I completely agree. Totally debunked that whole thinking. And we've seen it just play out over time. Now, you could make the argument, or some will, I'm not saying I am, that VR will be the new version of this. VR will make it so you can all meet in virtual space and never leave the house, but you're all in some kind of convention with thousands of you there because you're seeing the big virtual projection of all these bodies and people. That will be the one that'll keep us from getting together. And my guess is that'll be debunked as well, as often these things are. There'll just be a giant VR con that everyone will want to go to. And if you can't go, then sure, you could come in virtually, but that'll be interesting. VR, see, I think VR, we've talked about all the good things about VR. There's going to be a cultural old man in Congress backlash about VR for a while. It is going to be the new comic book ratings board. It's going to be the new video games senators who are worried about video game violence or explicit lyrics and rap songs in 1992. This is going to be the big new touchstone morality fight for the next 10 years. We just don't know it yet, because it's not in the hands of people yet. But when it is, oh, man, you watch. First kid that walks off a deck because he thought he was walking in a VR world and fell two stories to his death or whatever weird thing happens. This is all coming, man.
Oh, man.
It's all coming.
You're not wrong.
Just brace for it. It's going to happen. It'll all suss out in about 20 years when people are in power who grew up with VR. It'll be fine. Let's see. Let's do a quick email and then we'll get out of here. Feedback and calls, by the way, are awesome. We love them. Call our number 801-471-0462. Leave a voicemail or currentgeek@gmail.com. We'll have an email today from Swelterfish is his name. Love that name. Tom Scott and guest/guests. Forbes released their list of best places to work in the USA. How accurate could this possibly be? I don't know how they make it, but it smells funny to me, says Swelterfish. I don't know how they do that. Thing.
Well, first of all, it could be the swelterfish.
Just
try to rule that out first.
Something smells funny. Honestly, could be swelterfish.
When fish are sweltering.
But what do you? I don't know how they do that list, and it's always got Google on it. And
is not a new question to most of the world. I mean, since magazines were created, it seems like there have been these lists. And they were worse in the past. They would just be like, oh, Bob, come up with a list. And they just like dash something off, right?
Yeah.
So at least now they try to justify them with like, here's a little bit of how we came about the list, you know? And so if you dig into this Forbes thing, I'm guessing, I haven't read it, it'll probably have a small thing that attributes like how what their formula was or the rankings that they're using. But yeah, most of the time, they're very subjective.
Yeah. It's like saying, okay, Christian, let's do a little experiment. What's your favorite video game of all time, or what do you think is the greatest game ever made?
I mean, going back to Kanata and what we talked about on DLC, it's really hard to argue it's not Tetris. Okay. It's really hard to argue.
It kind of is. I agree with you. But I could just as easily come back to you and go, well, it's Mario 64. What are we even arguing about? Like, that game is the... Right? Like, you have these moments that so much of it depends on time and nostalgic and your age, when it happened, how it happened, how influential it was. Like, it's always going to be subjective. So I would say to this listener, this list on Forbes is like any other. There may be some science to it in that they asked employees through some kind of survey and only the companies who participated got the survey. Or I don't know how they did it, but there may be some things where they lead to bigger answers or more scientific answers. But at the end of the day, it still sort of just comes down to a popularity contest and what one magazine tells you is the case. So I would take it as the grain of salt that it is.
It's just too broad of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Best places to work for whom?
Yeah.
Best place to work for a construction worker is going to be different than best place to work for an office worker, which is different from the best place to work for a florist. So it's too broad of a category to really scientifically and rigorously determine, I think. Mm-hmm. There are studies out there that are done about livability, mm-hmm. and they talk about like standards of living, and they incorporate, you know, green space and wages and health and longevity and all of this stuff. And those you can look at and go, okay, at least there's a basis that they're providing for what their metric means. And so when they say it's the most livable city, I know what they mean by it. But a lot of times these things, you know, the best schools, it depends what you mean. Best schools for getting a job, best schools for being educated. Those can be different things.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you both say a lot of really offensive stuff over the course of this show. Yeah. But to sit here and say that Forbes isn't nailing the exact right list, that these are the best places to work for everybody, shame on you. Shame on it. I cannot.
We don't mean taken. To pick on Forbes.
Yeah. Quit trying to come up with a reason for why you guys are unhappy with your crappy jobs.
Which we both are.
Yeah. Because they're not on the list. You know, man up, go apply for a real big boy job.
Right.
And get on this list.
This reminds me of Tom. So Tom, you reminded me of like the most livable cities and all that stuff. Those lists that always come out. Like Provo, Utah is always on that list for whatever reason. Sometimes it's number one. It's always up there. And they're like 30 minutes from here. I freaking hate Provo. It's one of my least favorite cities ever. I don't like it there. I got food poisoned by a terrible burger there once. That's the least of my problems there. I just don't like it there. And, you know, nonetheless, there it is on this list based on all these arbitrary factors that for me don't work. So even that doesn't work for a lot of people. And
you know what, Christian, you've opened my eyes. I realize that if I'm going to criticize Forbes, I need to be as rich as a Forbes. And so I should just shut up until I make enough money that you can believe me.
Wait, do you mean make enough money to be mentioned in Forbes or make enough money to write for Forbes? Because I think you far exceed the latter.
He wants to be the Forbes. You want to be Forbes. Like you want to who
I want to be Michelle Forbes is what I want to be.
Yeah, right. Hey, you got the mole. You're halfway there. all right. There's your email. Thank you very much for that, Swelterfish, if that is indeed your real name. CurrentGeek@gmail.com is the email address. And again, the number to call, 801-471-0462. Cannot thank our guest, Christian Spicer, enough for being on with us today. Thanks, man, for being here.
Of course, yeah. And if you want to check out my stand-up album, it's Moment in Time. If you like it, leave a great review. If you don't like it, shut up. I don't. Don't leave a bad review. That's mean. Yeah, that hurts my feelings.
It is mean. What is the point? If you don't like it, just move on to something you like. And
so go to iTunes, right? Yeah. That's where you get it?
Yeah, iTunes. I also have it through CD Baby. You can find the direct link on my website.
Moment of Time. If you like it, give it a good review. If you don't like it, go apply for a job writing for Forbes.
See? Got it all worked out. You're also on DLC every week with Jeff Cannata, fantastic video game podcast, which can be found on iTunes at the 5x5 network at 5x5.com. And other places. Anything else with that you want to mention?
You should come back on.
Yeah, I love being on. It's always good to be on there.
We love guests. Both of you guys. Come talk. It's just games and it's fun and it's dumb.
You know, and I know Jeff wants to just talk about how great Heroes of the Storm is all the time. The problem is, so do I. So that might be bad.
Will Jeff make a dad joke for me?
Of course. For you? Yeah. I mean, because Carboni won't be there to shut him down.
Good point. All right. Well, it's been fantastic having you on. Have a fantastic time down there in Austin for the time you're there.
Thanks so much. This was awesome.
Thank you, everybody else, for joining us. Tom, anything else before we go?
Nope. TomAaronBooks.com.
Okay.
Buy the book.
Frogbands.com. Nerdtacular.com. Tickets still available, although they went really fast this year. There's a few left, so if you want in, now is your chance. Come see us. It'll be fun. I guess that's it. Oh, and a reminder, no show next week. Tom will be in Austin itself, and I will be here itself. And neither of us will be doing a show right then. Current Geek on Twitter, Scott Johnson on Twitter, and of course Ace Detect on Twitter. Oh, and C Spicer on Twitter, right? Or is it just Spicer?
Just Spicer, yeah. Oh, at Spicer.
Lucky bastard. That's a great name.
Well, thanks.
To have on the Twitter. CurrentGeek.reddit.com is our Reddit. You can find us at CurrentGeek.com for all our subscription info and everything else. And email us, CurrentGeek@gmail.com. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for Christian. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, based on a listener request from Joseph, we take a look at a question regarding selling fan art and fan-made items, including famous logos or characters. Joseph asks a question we see a lot during our summer gaming and comic convention series, that being whether booths that sell fan-made items like stained glass windows, leather flasks, and other items with superhero or video game logos are subject to IP infringement, and if so, how do they consistently get away with this? Here's the deal for such sellers. It's definitely copyright and or trademark infringement, and they run the risk of receiving a nasty cease and desist letter, if not a lawsuit, when they sell items using trademarked or copyrighted logos without permission. However, most of these small-time hobby businesses stay below the radar because it's too expensive for companies to go after every potential infringer, and in many cases, the sales actually help the market for the genuine goods, not hamper it. That leads to a laissez-faire attitude for many companies relative to these infringements. Obviously, some companies like Blizzard Entertainment are more scorched-earth approach than others, going after more potential infringers. But every company has a limit to how much they can pursue infringement issues, and that is precisely why these sellers at your local comic and gaming conventions get away with what is really blatant IP infringement. The risk these companies run is large. Should they lose an infringement lawsuit, any of the following remedies could apply: an injunction to stop the activity, handing over of any profits made, and potentially further money damages. Especially in copyright, some damages can be set by statute to some ridiculously significant value between $750 and $30,000 per infringement. If you remember the record companies going after Napster users, and the ridiculous fines and settlements paid, that's statutory damages coming into play. The bottom line is, if these companies remain what is truly a small business concern, they likely stay under the radar and probably have a low actual risk of these bad legal things happening. But they are undoubtedly committing infringement, which opens up the possibility of lawsuits. At the end of the day, it's a business decision, with associated risks and rewards like all business decisions. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions as segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
Hi, this is Phil with another game-punting pick of the week from the world of crowd-funded tabletop games. This week, we're backing Scavengers, a new role-playing game by Metalweave Games on Kickstarter. Scavengers is a humorous, competitive RPG where the players take on the role of professional looters in a war-torn sci-fi setting, with the objective of becoming the richest surviving crew member through skill, cunning, and perhaps a little backstabbing. Scavengers is all about risk and reward, but it's not just a combat system. Every type of challenge and response, whether it's settled with blasters or fast talk, is equally risky and uses the same danger point mechanic. You make more money by taking on more danger, but press your luck too far and you'll regret it. Assisting the Game Master in setting the adventure are a series of tables for generating the key points and challenges of the night, leaving more time for the best aspects of adventure design, fleshing out the intangibles. The random setting, loot, and challenge tables also allow for quick reaction to the players going in another direction, adding to the length of an evening's play or impromptu adventures off the cuff. The competitive nature of the game, with players working together to overcome challenges but keeping score between themselves, is a fun change of pace for most role players, and should prove to be popular with veterans of games like Paranoia, which used this great but often overlooked dimension in the past. Scavengers can be backed in both an inexpensive PDF-only level for $10, or add the print version for $35. The campaign is currently nearing their $5,000 funding goal, with the campaign running through March 14th. For more news and reviews of crowdfunded tabletop games, join us on the Game Punting Podcast, available on iTunes or at gamepunting.com. Happy gaming!
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there!